Inside the medical center. Torture chamber, more like. The rabbi knelt beside the gross female form and prayed, as he did so often. May our ancient God bless and forgive you, Rebecca. Though she was brain dead and her body no longer resembled the woman he had known, he insisted on using her given name. She had said she would be dreaming, living among those myriad lives within her. Was it true? Despite what he saw and smelled in this chamber of horrors, he would remember who she had been and honor her. 10 years as a tank. Mother of monsters. Why did you allow them to do this, daughter? And now, with the Gola project on hiatus, her body no longer even served the purpose for which she had sacrificed it. What a terrible thing. Her naked abdomen, adorned with tubes and monitors, was no longer swollen, but he had seen her several times as a mound carrying a pregnancy so unnatural that even God must turn his eyes from it. Rebecca and the other two Bene Gesserit women who had volunteered to become such horrors lay on sterile beds. Axolotl tanks. Even the name sounded unnatural, stripped of all humanity. For years, these tanks had produced Golas. Now they simply secreted chemical precursors that were processed into melange. Their bodies had become nothing more than detestable factories. The women were maintained with a constant stream of fluids, nutrients, and catalysts. Is any goal worth such a price? The rabbi whispered, not sure if he was beseeching the Almighty in prayer or asking Rebecca directly. In either event, he received no answer. With a shudder, he let his fingers touch Rebecca's belly. The Bene Gesserit doctors had often scolded him, telling him not to touch the tank. But though he despised what Rebecca had done to herself, he would never harm her. He was resigned to the fact that he could no longer save her either. The rabbi had looked in on the Gola children. They seemed innocent enough, but he was not fooled. He knew why these genetically ancient babies had been born, and he wanted no part of such an insidious plan. He heard someone arrive in the humming silence of the medical chamber and looked up to see a bearded man. Quiet, intelligent, and competent, Jacob had taken it upon himself to watch over the rabbi, as Rebecca had once done. I knew I would find you here, Rabbi. His expression was stern and scolding, one the old man himself might have used when he disapproved of someone else's behavior. We have been waiting for you. It is time. The rabbi glanced at a chronometer and realized how late it was. According to their calculations and the habits they followed, this was sunset on Friday, time to begin the 24 hours of Shabbat. He would say the prayers in their makeshift synagogue. He would read Psalm 29 from the original text, not the horribly bastardized version in the Orange Catholic Bible, and then his small group would sing. Preoccupied with his prayers and wrestling with his conscience, the old man had lost track of time. Yes, Jacob, I am coming. I'm sorry. The other man took the rabbi by the arm and helped him along, though he needed no assistance. Jacob leaned closer and reached out to brush unexpected tear streaks from the older man's cheeks. You are crying, Rabbi. The old man glanced back at what had once been a vibrant woman, Rebecca, stopped for a long, uncertain moment, and then permitted his companion to lead him from the medical chamber. Sue stones, highly valued jewels produced by the abraded carapace of a monoped sea creature, the colister, found only on Boozle. Sue stones absorb rainbows of color, depending upon the touch of flesh or how light falls on them. Because of their high value and portability, the small and perfectly round stones, like melange, are used as hard currency, especially in times of economic turmoil and social upheaval. Terminology of the Imperium, revised. With the smell of salt air around her, so different from the Chapter House desert, Mother Commander Mirbella surveyed the continuing operations on Boozle. In the past year, Reverend Mother Carista had sent the new sisterhood many shipments of Sue Stones, which covered other expenses while the spice production was devoted to paying for the armaments Richesi had begun to produce. Mirbella had distributed her spies widely, gathering information about the remaining rebel-honored Matre strongholds, preparing her long-term plan. Soon, she would be ready to move against the main enclaves in earnest. Recapturing Boozle and seizing all Sue Stone production had cut off the rest of the honored Matres from a primary source of wealth. It had both provoked and weakened the strongest remaining bastions of rebellious women. So far, the new sisterhood had subsumed 5 rebel strongholds in addition to Boozle. For every 100,000 that her female soldiers killed, they captured only 1,000. For every 1,000 captured, maybe 100 were successfully converted to the new sisterhood. Mirbella had declared to her advisors, "Rehabilitation is never guaranteed, but death is certain. No one needs to remind us how honored Matres think. Would they respect our pleas for unification? No. They need to be broken first." The last strongholds of the violent women would be tough nuts to crack, but Mirbella convinced herself that the Valkyries were up to the task. Not every conquest could be as clean and simple as the recapture of Boozle. Over the past several months, Carista had made many changes to the operations on the ocean planet, and the Mother Commander approved. From the beginning, Carista, the woman who had lost 2 babies, had been willing to help. Even before sharing with Mirbella, she seemed to remember a good deal about being a Bene Gesserit. The Boozle settlements consisted of only a few buildings and defensive towers on the patchy outcroppings of rock and hardscrabble islands, along with large boats, processing barges, and anchored rafts. Under Carista's supervision, many of the resentful Bene Gesserit exiles had initially demanded to be transferred away from the rough Sue Stone labor. Some had been petulant and wanted revenge on the vicious whores. Pointedly leaving the most strident exiles in their old assignments, Carista, thinking much like Mirbella, had promoted others to be special local advisors. She had commandeered the reasonably comfortable quarters that Matre Skira and her whores had taken from the Bene Gesserit exiles and ordered the remaining handful of honored Matres to erect their own thin tents on the rocky ground. Mirbella understood that this was a means of control rather than revenge. Skira and her group, as well as the Bene Gesserit exiles, had been isolated from outside politics for a long time. Clearly, uniting these particular women was another difficult alliance and a significant challenge to Carista's leadership abilities. But gradually, the women were learning the benefits of working together. It was like a microcosm of what had happened at Chapter House. Now, on the afternoon of the second day of her follow-up inspection, the Mother Commander toured the revamped Sue Stone operations, accompanied by Carista and the honored Matre Skira. Nearby, 12 workers, all honored Matre survivors, continued washing and sorting stones according to their size and color, the work they had once forced the Bene Gesserit exiles to do. Phibian guards no longer stood over the workers. Mirbella wondered if the aquatic people had noticed or cared that their female masters had changed. Beneath the surface of the water, Phibian divers trapped and corralled the large, slow-moving shellfish. Collisters had a fleshy, probing body covered by a thick and lumpy carapace. Persistent abrasions of that casing produced hard, milky scars that could be chipped off like gems embedded in rock. The slow growth of the nodules, the scarcity of the sea creatures themselves, and the difficulty of harvesting deep underwater all contributed to the rarity and value of the gems. When the honored Matres brought in the hybrid amphibians, production increased dramatically. The amphibious people lived in the sea, swam deep without any special equipment, and ranged far from the island outcroppings as they hunted for the slowly wandering colisters. Standing on the dock with her new advisors, Mirbella turned toward a large amphibian male who stood at the reef's edge. Apparently he had once been a guard, for he still carried his barbed whip. Four other amphibian deep divers crouched together on the rocky beach where they had just delivered a load of sou stones. The honored Matres did not know exactly where the amphibians had come from, just somewhere out in the scattering a long time ago. Skira said that the amphibious half-breeds were an insular species with only limited vocabularies, but Mirbella's Bene Gesserit instincts told her otherwise. The memories she had shared with Carista added evidence to this. The amphibians were more than they appeared to be. Ordering her two escorts to accompany her, Mirbella skittered down a spray-slick rock stairway to the shingle beach. "This is not safe," Skira ran to catch up with the Mother Commander. "Amphibians can be violent. Last week, one of them drowned an honored Matre. Took her out and pulled her underwater. She probably deserved it. Do you doubt that the three of us can defend ourselves?" Nearby, a squad of Mirbella's Valkyries also watched over their commander, weapons at the ready. Carista pointed to the group. "The tallest one is our best producer. See the scar on his forehead? He dives the deepest and brings back the most sou stones." From a flash of Carista's memory, Mirbella recalled the abandoned amphibian baby she had rescued from a tide pool. He'd had a scar on his forehead, a claw mark. Could this be the same one from so many years ago? The one she called Sea Child? She recalled other instances, other encounters. Yes. This aquatic male definitely knew who Carista was. The scarred amphibian was the first to notice the women approaching. All of the creatures turned warily, blinking their slitted eyes. Three smaller amphibians retreated into the foaming water where they hovered out of reach. The scarred one, though, held his ground. Mirbella regarded him carefully, trying to read his alien body language for some clue as to what he was thinking. Though shorter than the creature, she assumed a confident fighting posture. For a long moment, the amphibian regarded her with his membranous eyes. Then he spoke in a throaty voice that sounded like a dripping rag drawn through a pipe.
"Boss, boss."
"What do you mean?"
"You. Boss, boss."
Carista interpreted.
"He knows you are the boss of all the bosses."
"Yes, I am your boss now." He bowed his head deferentially. "I think you're a good deal smarter than you let on. Are you a good amphibian?"
"Not good. Best."
Boldly, Mirbella took a step closer. Other than what she knew from Carista, she had no idea about the amphibians' social inclinations or taboos.
"You and I are both leaders in our own way.
And as one leader to another, I promise that we will no longer treat you the way the honored Matres did. You have already seen the changes. We won't use lash on you or let you use it on anyone else. Work for all, benefit for all."
"No more lash."
He lifted his chin, proud and stern.
"No more sou stones for smugglers."
Mirbella tried to process what he was implying. Was it a promise or a threat? Surely, after a year, the Phibians must have noticed a significant difference in their lives.
Smugglers are always a problem, Carista explained to her. We can't stop them from taking Sue stones out in the open water.
The nostrils flared in Skira's beak-like nose. We have long suspected the Phibians also traded with smugglers, stealing our Sue stone harvests and providing for themselves.
Not your Sue stones, the Phibian said with a long, bubbling rumble.
Mirbella felt she was on the verge of an interesting breakthrough. You promise not to deal with smugglers if we treat you fairly. Is that what you mean?
Skira sounded mortally offended.
Phibians are slaves, subhuman creatures. They do what they are created to do.
Mirbella regarded her with a murderous glare.
Provoke me if you dare. I am perfectly willing to kill another arrogant whore to make my point.
Skira met her eyes like a mouse facing a rattlesnake. At last, she bowed and then took a small step back.
Yes, great honored Matre. I did not mean to offend.
The Phibian seemed amused.
No more smugglers.
Carista explained,
the smugglers have always been smart enough to leave us most of the haul. They were an irritation to the honored Matres, maybe, but not enough of a thorn to require massive retaliation.
Skira grumbled, we would have crushed them sooner or later.
What could the smugglers pay you? Mirbella asked the creature, ignoring Skira.
What do Phibians want?
Smugglers bring spice. We give Sue stones.
So that was it. Though the guild was desperate for melange, and Mirbella still refused to provide them with anything more than a trickle for their bare necessities, smuggling groups and black market traders had begun to disseminate their own hoarded spice. From her single suit pocket, she produced a small cinnamon-colored tablet and handed it to the Phibian.
We have more melange than smugglers could ever bring to you.
With a perplexed expression, the creature held it in his webbed hand and then sniffed cautiously. The thick-lipped smile returned.
Spies. Good.
With a very serious expression, he stared at the tablet of melange in his hand, but did not attempt to swallow it.
You will get along just fine with the Sisterhood.
We think the same way.
Mirbella pointed at the tablet of melange.
You keep. Trade?
She shook her head.
No. A gift. For you.
He doesn't understand the concept of a gift. It's not part of their culture, Skira said. Slaves are not accustomed to having any possessions. Mirbella wondered if all honored Matres were so blind and simplistic and full of preconceptions.
The Phibian leader said, smugglers taught us.
Either not understanding or refusing the gift, he handed the tablet back to her, reverently rather than spitefully, and waded into the water next to his companions. Soon his head disappeared beneath the waves, and the other three deep divers followed.
Skira sniffed.
If your sisterhood has so much melange, we can pay Phibians with it to stay away from smugglers and give us all the Sue stones.
As soon as I return to Chapter House, I'll issue new orders.
We will provide melange to the Phibians if they need it. Mirbella looked at Carista, wondering how long it had been since the exiled sister had received a dose herself. Surely during the honored Matre domination, the exiled sisters had been cut off. They would have gone through terrible withdrawal. But then,
In her shared memories with Carista, she recalled instances where the scarred Phibian, Sea Child, had delivered some of the melange obtained from smugglers, secreting it among the rocks where Carista could find it. And we will give spice to any others here who may need it as well. Superstitions and nonsense from the past should not prevent us from making progress. If we hold ourselves back, we admit that our fears are more powerful than our abilities. The Fabricators of Ix. When the Ixian chief fabricator sent his message to the guild announcing success with the new navigation machines, a small delegation raced to Ix. The speed with which they arrived told Crone everything he needed to know. The guild administrators were much more desperate than they let on. He and his face dancers had drawn out the invention phase for 8 years now, the shortest time he could justify for the reintroduction of such a drastically sophisticated new technology. He could not afford to raise too many questions from the guild or even the Ixians. The extraordinary new device could guide any ship safely and efficiently. No navigator, and hence no spice, was necessary. Crone would have them eating out of his hand. Wearing a gray formal suit made of a plaid silk that had an oily sheen, Crone stood quietly beside Chief Fabricator Shyama Sen. Though the Baron Harkonnen Gola and the one-year-old Paul Atreides needed constant tending in their isolation on Caladan, Crone had decided to come to Ix to observe this interaction for himself. Administrator Goris entered the room accompanied by 6 other men. In addition to guild functionaries, Crone noted a representative of the Independent Guild Bank and a master merchant from Chome. It seemed that the guild administrators had pointedly not brought a navigator to these discussions. Instead, the delegation had left him in his spice-filled chamber high above and isolated in his orbiting ship. Oh, how they must be thirsting after the new technology. This time they met in a small, intimate chamber, not the large manufacturing bay with the clamor of industrial noises that had so dominated their first meeting. Sen called for refreshments, drawing out the moment. He seemed to enjoy the anticipation. "Gentlemen, commerce across the galaxy is about to change forever. What you desire is in your hands, thanks to Ixian innovation." Goris tried to conceal his eagerness with a skeptical expression. "Your claims are impressive and extravagant, Chief Fabricator." "They are also true." Crone played his meek role, serving sweet confections and a robust drink that was, ironically, considering the nature of the meeting, heavily laced with melange. As Administrator Goris politely consumed the proffered treats, he scanned the technical reports and testing results provided by Crone's team. "These new Ixian navigation machines seem to be 1,000 times more accurate than the previous ones we incorporated into some of our guild ships. Much better than anything used in the scattering." The chief fabricator took a long sip of his hot melange beverage. "Never underestimate Ixians, guildsmen. We notice you did not include a navigator in these discussions." Goris put on a haughty air. "He was not necessary." Crone suppressed a smile. That statement was true on several levels. "Humanity has been searching for an accurate navigational system for millennia. Think of how many ships were lost during the famine times," the guild banker said, his face suddenly florid. "We expected you would take decades to achieve such a dramatic overhaul from first principles." Sen beamed proudly at Crone. Even the chief fabricator assumed that the recent breakthroughs were based on real Ixian knowledge and ingenuity, not brought in from the outside enemy. The Chome Master Merchant scowled at the Guild Banker. This is nothing new. Obviously, Ixians must have been working on forbidden technology in secret all along. And much to our benefit, I might add, Goris interrupted, cutting off any possible argument. We Ixians do not rest on our laurels. Shyama Sen then quoted one of the tenets of Ix. Those who do not actively pursue progress and innovation soon find themselves at the tail end of history. Crone interceded before foolish questions could be raised. We prefer to call these new devices mathematical compilers to avoid inadvertent confusion with thinking machines of any kind. These compilers simply automate the processes that a navigator or even a Mentat can do. We do not wish to raise the ugly specter that led to the Butlerian Jihad. He listened to his own euphemisms and rationalizations, knowing that these men would do exactly what they wanted to do anyway, regardless of laws and moral restrictions. They were just imaginative and greedy enough to provide any necessary justifications should questions come up. Shyama Sen added with a stern edge to his voice, "If you gentlemen had any doubts, you would not be here." By pretending uneasiness and citing ancient prohibitions against thinking machines, are you trying to bully us into lowering our price? That will never work. He set his cup down, but continued smiling. In fact, it makes commercial sense for us to offer this technology more widely. We believe the new sisterhood would be particularly eager to obtain navigation devices of their own to build an autonomous fleet. They deal with the Spacing Guild now because they have little choice. How much would they pay for their independence, I wonder? At this, Administrator Goris, the Guild Banker, and the Chome representative all cried foul, an overlapping litany of protests. They had suggested this line of development in the first place. They had been promised exclusivity. They had already agreed to pay an exorbitant amount. Crone intercepted the comments before they could turn into an outright argument. He did not wish to let his carefully laid plans be sidetracked. The chief fabricator is simply offering an example to make certain you understand the value of our technological development. While you gentlemen believe you have some claims to originating this work, you must also realize we could take bids from elsewhere. There will be no raising or lowering of the agreed-upon price. Sen nodded briskly. All right, let's not waste time with such ploys. Our price may be high, but you will pay it. No more outrageous melange expenditures. No more dependence on capricious navigators. You are visionary businessmen, and even a child can see the immense profits that will accrue to the Guild once your ships are fitted with our... He paused to recall the term Crone had suggested, mathematical compilers. Then he turned to the Chome man, who had eaten all of his confections and finished his hot spice beverage. I trust I do not need to explain this to a master merchant. Chome has to keep up trade even during wartime. Richesi is reaping huge profits by building a vast military force for the new sisterhood. The Ixian chief fabricator gave an annoyed grunt at the reminder. Administrator Goris seemed very excited. Previously, when we installed primitive navigation machines on guild ships, we still carried a navigator aboard each vessel. He looked apologetically at the chief fabricator. We did not entirely trust your earlier machines, you see, but back then we didn't have to. There were questions of reliability, a few too many missing ships. Now, however, with the new sisterhood's stranglehold on supplies and the proven accuracy of your compilers, I see no reason not to rely on your navigation machines.
So long as they work as well as you've promised, the guild banker said.
When it was obvious that everyone believed in the new mathematical compilers, Crone planted his seed of discord. You know, of course, that this change will make navigators obsolete. They are not likely to be pleased.
Administrator Goris shifted uncomfortably and glanced from the banker to his fellow guildsman.
Yes, we know. That is most unfortunate. Our motivations are as important as our goals. Use this to understand your enemy. With such knowledge, you can either defeat him or, better, manipulate him into becoming your ally. Bashar Miles Tegg, Memoirs of a Battle Commander.
The crisis among the navigators was so severe that Edric sought an audience with the Oracle of Time herself. Navigators used prescience to guide fold space ships, not to observe human events. The administrator faction had duped them, bypassed them. The esoteric navigators had never considered the activities and desires of people outside the guild to be relevant. What folly! The Spacing Guild had been caught completely off guard by the loss of spice and the intractability of the only remaining suppliers. A quarter century had passed since the destruction of Rakkus. To make matters worse, the honored Matres had foolishly exterminated every Tliloxu master who knew how to produce melange from axolotl tanks. Now, with so many groups desperate for spice, the navigators had been forced to the brink of a treacherous cliff. Perhaps the Oracle could offer a solution that Edric could not see. In their earlier encounter, she had hinted there might be a solution to their dilemma. He was certain, however, that it did not involve navigation machines. Faced with such a difficult situation, Edric commanded that his tank be delivered to the giant, ages-old enclosure that held the Oracle of Time whenever she chose to manifest in this physical universe. Intimidated in her presence, Edric had spent a great deal of time planning his argument and marshaling his thoughts, knowing all the while it could be a pointless exercise. With prescience far superior and more expansive than any navigator's, the Oracle must already have foreseen this encounter and imagined every word Edric would speak. Humbled, he looked out through his curved tank at the Oracle's translucent structure. Long ago, arcane symbols had been etched into the walls. Coordinates, hypnotic designs, ancient runes, mysterious markings that only the Oracle comprehended. Her enclosure reminded him of a miniature cathedral, and Edric felt like her supplicant.
Oracle of Time, we face our greatest emergency since the time of the Tyrant. Your navigators are starving for spice, and our own administrators plot against us. He shuddered with the strength of his own anger. The foolish lesser guildsmen believed they could solve the problem by creating better Ixion navigation machines. Inferior copies. The guild needed spice, not artificial mathematical compilers. I beseech you, show us our path to survival.
He sensed an enormous thunderstorm of thoughts, the incredibly complex preoccupation of the churning mind hidden within the swirling mists. When the Oracle answered, Edric felt that she was granting him only the tiniest fraction of her attention while her brain was focused elsewhere on much larger issues.
There is always an insatiable hunger for spice. It is a small problem.
A small problem,
Hedrick said, incredulous. All of his arguments were washed away. Our stockpiles are nearly exhausted, and the new sisterhood doles out only a tiny fraction of what we need. Navigators could become extinct. What could be a more vital problem?
Kralizek, I will call all my navigators again when I require them.
But how can we assist you if we have no melange? How can we survive?
You will find another way to obtain spice. This I have foreseen. A forgotten way. But you must discover it yourself.
The sudden silence in his mind told Edric that the Oracle was finished with this conversation and had gone back to pondering her greater questions. He clung to her startling pronouncement. Another source of spice. Rakkis was destroyed. The new sisterhood refused to release their stockpiles, and the Tliloxu masters were all dead. Where else could the navigators search? Since the Oracle herself had spoken it, he was confident there was a solution. As he drifted, Edric let his thoughts spin out. Could there be another planet with sandworms? Another natural source of spice? What about a new or rediscovered means of manufacturing melange? What had been forgotten? Only the Tliloxu had known how to produce spice artificially. Was there a way to rediscover that knowledge? Did someone else still know the technique? That information had long ago been buried by the clumsy, honored Matres. How could it be dredged up again? The masters had carried their secrets to the grave. But even death did not always erase knowledge. Elders of the lost Tliloxu, shadow brothers of the once great masters, did not know how to create melange. But they did know how to grow golas. And golas could have their memories triggered. Suddenly, Edric knew the answer. Or thought he did. If he resurrected one of the old masters, then he could wrest that knowledge free, and the damnable sisterhood would be left without their advantage once again. The unexplored vastness into which humans fled in the scattering was a hostile wilderness, filled with unexpected traps and dangerous beasts. Those who survived were hardened and changed in ways that we cannot fully comprehend. Reverend Mother Tamerlane, Chapter House Archives, Projections and Analyses of the Scattering. Shianna sat cross-legged on the hard floor of the Arboretum while the four futars prowled around her. She used Bene Gesserit's skills to slow her heartbeat and respiration rate. After the one called Herm watched her dance with the sandworms, the shared awe among the beastmen had kept her safe among them. Although she controlled the scents that came from her body, she did not avert her gaze. Most of the time the futars walked on 2 feet, but occasionally they reverted to a four-pawed pacing. Restless. Always restless. Shianna had not moved for several minutes. The futars twitched each time she blinked, and then they went back to their restless prowling. Herm came close to her and sniffed. She lifted her chin and sniffed back. Despite the potential violence in these creatures, she knew it was important for her to be with them inside this large chamber. After continued study, Shianna was convinced the futars could reveal much more if only she could sift the information out of them. In the deep unknowns of the scattering, they had been bred by handlers specifically to hunt down honored matres. But who were the handlers? Did they know of the enemy? Maybe she could winnow out a vital key to the origin of the whores and the nature of the old man and woman Duncan said were pursuing them.
More food, Herm said, pacing around close to her. His wiry body hair was rank and his breath smelled like partially digested meat.
You've already eaten well today. If you eat too much, you will grow fat. Then you will be slow on the hunt.
Hungry, one of the other Futars said.
You are always hungry. Food will come later.
It was a biological impulse for them to want to eat constantly, and their honored Matre captors had kept them on the verge of starvation. The Bene Gesserit, however, maintained a regular, healthy feeding schedule.
Tell me about the handlers.
She had asked the question hundreds of times, trying to get a few extra words out of Herm, another kernel of information.
Where, handlers? The Futar asked, his interest suddenly piqued.
They are not here, and I can't find them unless you help me.
Futars and handlers. Partners.
Herm stretched his muscles, snuffling. The other creatures bristled and flexed their cable-like muscles as if proud of their physical appearance. Apparently, when the Futars had a focus, it was difficult to get them to consider other matters. In any event, Shiana had convinced Herm, and to a lesser extent the other three, that the Bene Gesserits were different from honored Matres. Herm had entirely forgotten that he had murdered a proctor years ago. Though the sisters were not the much-anticipated handlers, the Futars had finally accepted that these women were not to be killed and eaten, like honored Matres. At least, Shiana hoped so. Slowly, she uncrossed her legs and rose to her feet.
Hungry, Herm said again. Want food now.
You'll get food. We never forget to feed you, do we?
Never forget, Herm confirmed.
Where handlers? Another Futar asked.
Not here. Far away.
Want handlers.
Soon.
As soon as you help us find them. She left the Arboretum enclosure as the Futars bounded through the artificial trees, searching relentlessly for something they would never find on the Ithaca. She took special care to lock the chamber securely behind her. It is often easier for us to destroy each other than it is to resolve our differences. Such is the cosmic joke of human nature. Mother Commander Mirbella, Chapter House Meeting Notes. In order to receive their small but desperately needed rations of melange, the Guild regularly sent highliners to Chapter House. The ships carried supplies, recruits for the new sisterhood, and surveillance information collected from far-flung scouts. Mirbella kept a careful watch on the rebel honored Matre strongholds, preparing for her next major offensive with the Valkyries. 6 hours before the regular Guild ship was scheduled to arrive, a smaller vessel careened into the system. Immediately upon emerging from fold space, the ship began to broadcast an emergency warning. The small craft from the scattering had an unusual oval design, Holtzman engines, and its own no-field that flickered in and out of phase. Spewing out high levels of radiation in its exhaust, the ship had probably been damaged during its headlong flight to Chapter House. It maneuvered erratically as it approached. Upon being notified, Mirbella raced to the Keep's communication center, afraid this might be another embattled honored Matre ship from far outside the old empire. On the screen, the crackling image was so filled with static that she could barely make out the vague outline of a pilot. Only after the ship burned all its remaining fuel to achieve a barely stable orbit did the transmission resolve enough that Mirbella could discern the face of a priestess of the cult of Shiana, who had been dispatched by the Missionaria Protectiva
to promote the wild new religion. Mother Commander, we bring dire news. An urgent warning.
Mirbella could see figures with her in the oval ship's crowded cockpit, but the sister had not used any code words to denote that she was being forced or held captive. Knowing the others were listening, but not knowing who they were, Mirbella carefully selected her words after identifying the young woman.
Yes. Iriel.
Where have you come from?
Gamu.
With every moment, the transmitted images became clearer. Mirbella could see five people inside the vessel's piloting chamber. Many of them wore traditional clothing of Gamu. The anxious passengers appeared to be bruised and battered. Dried blood caked their cheeks and clothes. At least two of those aboard appeared to be either dead or unconscious.
No choice. No chance. We had to take the risk.
Mirbella snapped at the nearest woman in the communication center.
Send up a retrieval ship. Get those people down here safely. Now. Not much time,
the priestess transmitted. Her whole body shook with utter weariness.
Need to warn you. We escaped from Gamu before the Highliner departed, but the horrors nearly killed us. They know what we discovered. When is the guild ship coming?
We still have several hours, Mirbella said, trying to sound reassuring.
It may be sooner, Mother Commander. They know.
What do they know?
What have you discovered?
Obliterators. The honored Matres on Gamu still have four obliterators. They received orders from their Matre Superior Helica on Tlilox. They are coming here aboard the guild ship. They mean to destroy Chapter House.
Though not severely injured, Priestess Iria was exhausted and nearly starved. She had used all of her bodily reserves to help the small ship escape. Three of her six companions died before they could receive medical attention. The others were taken to the keep's infirmary.
Before resting, Iriel insisted on finishing the report to her mother commander, even though she could barely remain upright. Mirbella summoned potent melange drinks, and the stimulant temporarily revived the battered young woman. Iriel told of her ordeal on Gamu. She had been assigned to that planet for several years now, given orders to prepare the populace for the coming conflict. By preaching the message of Shiana and the need to stand against the outside enemy, Iriel had cultivated wholehearted fanatical followers. The more concerned the people of Gamu grew about the danger from the outside, the more they wanted to hear Iriel's message of hope and urgency. But the rebel honored Matres also had one of their strongest enclaves there. As the cult spread, the entrenched whores had struck, hunting down Shiana's followers. Perversely, the persecution made the cultists more resolute and determined. When Iriel had asked for their help in stealing this vital information and escaping from Gamu, she'd had no trouble finding volunteers. 15 of her brave followers had died before the warning ship could take off.
You have done what was required of you, Iriel. You delivered your warning in time. Now go recover.
Mirbella held the Redulian crystal sheets that the priestess had stolen from the honored Matres. Just then, the Highliner arrived, 2 hours ahead of schedule. Iriel glanced knowingly at her mother commander.
Our work is only just beginning.
Mirbella had hoped for more time, but had not counted on it. Only an hour earlier, suspensor-propelled launchers had placed hundreds of new-design Rachazian space mines in orbit. Concealed by individual no-fields, they drifted in the orbital zones where Highliners traditionally parked. Her battle orders had already been issued, and as soon as the giant guild ship appeared, the members of the new sisterhood went to work. Her daughter Jeunesse would lead one of the primary strike teams, but the mother commander intended to be in the fight right beside her.
She would never let herself become a mere bureaucrat. According to the priestess, the honored Matres had bribed this Highliner crew to transport them to Chapter House, which directly violated Spacing Guild prohibitions. Another example of how the Guild looked sideways whenever it was convenient for them. Was the navigator even aware of the obliterators on board the honored Matre frigate? Even if the Guild wanted to punish the new sisterhood for withholding Melange, Mirbella didn't think they were foolish enough to allow Chapter House to become a charred ball. This was their only source of spice, their last chance. Mirbella decided that one bribe deserved another, if only to show the Guild that honored Matres could never hope to compete financially against the sisterhood. With her Sue Stones, her spice stockpiles, and the sandworms in the desert belt, Mirbella could outbid anyone and garnish it with a significant threat. Before the great ship's cargo doors could open to disgorge any Chome vessels or hidden honored Matre ships, Mirbella transmitted an insistent call. She wore an implacable expression. "Attention, Guild Highliner. Your sensors will show that I have just placed a swarm of Richesian mines around your vessel." She gave a signal, and the no-fields around the mines dropped away. Hundreds of the glittering, mobile explosives winked into view like diamond chips in space. "If you open your doors or release any ships, I will direct those mines to strike your hull and turn you into space dust." The navigator attempted to protest. Guild administrators came on the comm line, crying foul. But Mirbella did not reply. She calmly transmitted copies of the Redulian crystal sheets Iriel had brought and allowed 2 minutes of silence for them to absorb the information. Then she said, "As you can see, we are perfectly justified in destroying your Highliner, both to prevent the release of the obliterators and to impose a fitting punishment on the Guild. Our Richesian explosives could do the job without my having to risk the life of a single sister. I assure you, Mother Commander, we have no knowledge of such heinous weapons aboard. Even the most amateur truthsayer could detect your lies, Guildsman." She cut off his protests, gave him a moment to regroup and become rational again, and then continued in a more reasonable tone. "Another alternative, one which I prefer because it would not destroy all those innocent passengers you carry, is for you to welcome us aboard and let us capture the honored Matres and their obliterators. In fact," she ran a finger along her lips, "I will even be generous. Provided you cooperate without further delay and don't insult our intelligence by protesting your innocence, we will grant you 2 full measures of spice after our mission is successfully completed." The navigator hesitated for several moments, then accepted. "We will identify which small frigates in the hold came from Gamu. Presumably, they carry honored Matres and obliterators. You will need to deal with those women yourselves." Mirbella flashed a predatory smile. "I wouldn't have it any other way." Weary and sore but exhilarated, the Mother Commander stood proudly beside her daughter in the blood-spattered hold of one of the unmarked honored Matre ships. 11 of the whores lay on the deck, their leotards torn, their bodies snapped. Mirbella had not expected any of the honored Matres to let themselves be captured alive. 6 of her own sisters had also died in the hand-to-hand combat. One of the slain Bene Gesserits was, sadly, the brave priestess Iriel, who had begged to join in the fight despite her weariness. Driven by a fire of vengeance, she had killed 2 of the whores herself before a thrown knife caught her between the shoulder blades. As Iriel died, Myrbella herself had shared with her in order to learn all that the woman knew about Gamu and the infestation of the whores there. The threat was worse than Myrbella had imagined. She would have to deal with it immediately. Teams of male workers used suspensor pallets to remove the spiked, ominous-looking obliterators, two from the hatches below each of the honored Matre frigates. The angry rebels had no compunctions about destroying a whole planet and its inhabitants just to decapitate the new sisterhood. They would have to be punished. "We need to study these weapons," Myrbella said, excited by the prospect of duplicating them. "We must reproduce the technology. We will need thousands of them once the enemy arrives." Janess looked grimly at the dead body of the priestess on the floor and at the slaughtered whores strewn like dolls in the ship's corridors. Simmering anger colored her cheeks. "Perhaps we should use one of the obliterators against Gamu and wipe out those women once and for all." Myrbella smiled with anticipation. "Oh, we will indeed move on Gamu next. But it will be a much more personal attack. We never see the jaws of the hunter closing around us until the fangs draw blood." Duncan, Idaho, 1,000 lives. Duncan tapped the touchpads of the instrument console to alter course slightly as the Ithaca moved through empty space. Without charts or records, he had no way of knowing if any humans had gone this far in the scattering. It made no difference. For 14 years, they had been flying blind, going nowhere. To reduce the risk of a navigational disaster, Duncan only rarely activated the Holtzman engines. At least he had kept them safe. So far. Some of the passengers, especially Garimi and her faction, as well as the rabbi's people, were growing increasingly restless. By now, dozens of children had been born and were being raised by Bene Gesserit proctors in isolated sections of the Ithaca. They all wanted a home. "We can't keep running forever," Garimi had said during one of their recent all-hands meetings. "Yes, we can. We may have to." The giant self-contained ship needed refueling only once or twice a century, since it was able to gather most of what it needed from the rarefied sea of molecules scattered throughout space. The no ship had been cruising for years without making another leap through fold space. Duncan had taken them farther than the imaginations of those who charted space. Not only had he eluded the enemy, he had slipped away from the Oracle of Time, never knowing whom to trust. In all that time, he had seen no sign of the glittering net, but it made him uneasy to remain in one area for long. "Why do the old man and woman want us so badly? Is it me they're after? Is it the ship? Or is it someone else aboard?" As Duncan waited, letting his thoughts drift along with the vessel itself, he felt the overlappings of his own lifetimes. So many lifetimes. The mergings of flesh and consciousness, the flow of experience and imagination, the great teachings and the epic events he had experienced. He sifted through countless lifetimes, all the way back to his original boyhood on Giri Prime under Harkonnen tyranny, and later on Caladan as the loyal weapons master of House Atreides. He had given his first life to save Paul Atreides and Lady Jessica. Then the Tliloxu had restored him as a Gola called Hate, and afterward many Duncan Idaho incarnations had served the capricious God Emperor. So much pain. So much exhilaration. He, Duncan Idaho, had been present at many critical moments in human history, from the fall of the old empire and the rise of Muad'Dib, through the long rule and death of the God Emperor, and beyond. Through it all, history had been distilling events, processing and sifting them through the Duncans, renewing them. Long ago, he had loved the beautiful, dark-haired Aaliyah, even with all her strangeness. Centuries later, he had loved Siona deeply, though it was obvious the God Emperor had thrown them together intentionally. In all of his Gola lifetimes, he had loved many beautiful, exotic women. Why then was Mirbella so difficult to get over? He could not break the debilitating bond she had with him. Duncan had slept little in the past week because whenever he went to his cot and clasped his pillow, he could only think of Mirbella, sensing the emptiness where her body wasn't. So many years. Why wouldn't the ache and addictive longing fade? Restless and wanting to put even more distance between himself and Mirbella's siren call, he erased the current navigation coordinates, used his bold or reckless intuition, and made a random fold space jump. When they arrived at a new and uncharted portion of space, Duncan let his mind drift in a fugue state, deeper than a Mentat's trance. Though he did not admit it to himself, he was looking for any hint of Mirbella's presence, though she could not possibly be here. Obsession. Duncan could not concentrate, and his wool gathering left them vulnerable to the gossamer yet deadly net that began to coalesce unnoticed around the no-ship. Teg arrived on the navigation bridge, saw Duncan at the controls, and noted that the other